Some say the greatest threat to America.
These drug cartels represent a clear and present danger to the national security of the United States.
Comes from other nations. Some say the greatest threat to America.
The course of action I'd suggest is a course of action I can't suggest.
Comes from within. Paramount Pictures presents this summer's most electrifying motion picture. Clear and present danger.
Welcome to episode 3 of Unclear and Present Danger, a podcast about the political and military thrillers of the 1990s and what they say about the politics of that decade. I'm Jamel Bowie. I'm a columnist for the New York Times opinion section.
I'm John Gans. I'm a columnist for Gawker, and I'm also working on a book about American politics in the early 90s.
Today, obviously, we are talking about our namesake, the movie Clear and Present Danger from 1994, directed by Philip Noyce, who directed Patriot Games, the previous movie in the Jack Ryan franchise, and who will go on to direct other movies that we will cover on this podcast. In the last episode, I had said I wasn't too familiar with Philip Noyce's career, but as I looked into it ahead of this episode, I realized that I've actually seen a bunch of his movies, and it's very much a 90s, you know, thriller director. So we'll dive into more of his stuff later. But before we get to the conversation about Noyce or about this movie, let's talk about what happened on the day this movie was released. This movie came out on August 3rd, 1994. We both have a copy of the New York Times from that day, and the headlines, I think, are actually kind of relevant to the movie. John, how about you take it? You take the headlines.
So some interesting stuff going on. There's an article about how Mandela, South Africa, which I believe that this was shortly after the first free multiracial elections in South Africa, is having trouble attracting foreign investors. There's an exchange between Deputy Treasury Secretary Robert Altman and Alphonse D'Amato, where Altman was accused of lying about Whitewater. If anybody remembers Whitewater, it was the scandal that the Clintons had something kind of improper, I think, real estate deals with their law firm. More seriously, there's an article about Rwanda and how there were plans now to the headline reads, Rwanda plans to try thousands for massacres, new leader says. This was not long after the Rwanda genocide, after the mostly Hutu government had been overthrown, that oversaw the genocide and replaced with Paul Kagame's government, and they were, I think, planning to do trials for the war crimes. There's a piece about the Mitchell plan, Senator George Mitchell's plan for healthcare, which would cover 95% of the public by the year 2000, but without making employers pay. And we all know that came true.
yes. We all thank the Mitchell plan for saving the American healthcare system.
Yes. And then there is another article about a drug company merger. There was an article about the U.S. FDA trying to finally regulate nicotine in cigarettes. They're arrested. 22 are arrested in thefts of Kennedy Airport cargo. I wonder if this was the same heist that's depicted. Yes, it is. It's the same heist that's depicted in Goodfellas, which was a famous robbery by the mafia at Kennedy Airport, the Lufthansa heist.
This is the Lufthansa. Wait.
Yeah.
No, this isn't. This is different.
This is not
a different one. They referenced the Lufthansa.
Oh, they referenced it. Okay, it's not. It's not that. Okay, but they got Dom Perignon champagne, Reebok sneakers, and Kodak. A $1 million shipment of Kodak film. Okay, it's a different heist, but it's another big.
I mean, I could personally use a bunch of Kodak film and some Reebok sneakers.
So. Yeah. How much do you think $1 million of Kodak probably? These days, it's not that much. I don't know.
I mean, it's still a good amount.
It's a lot of film. Yeah.
So, you know, I said that the headlines were relevant to the movie just because this headline about Altman lying or being accused of lying to Congress, and then this headline about regulating nicotine just relates to the plot of the movie, which involves congressional hearings and lying to Congress and drug regulation and so on and so forth. But before we move on to our discussion of this movie, just a few quick notes on the film. Again, directed by Philip Noyce, screenplay, first credit goes to John Milius, who worked on Hunt for Red October, directed a bunch of movies you're familiar with, Conan the Barbarian, Red Dawn, so on and so forth. Obviously based off of the novel Clear and Present Danger by Tom Clancy. And starring a bunch of people from Patriot Games, Harrison Ford, obviously, Ann Archer as his wife, James Earl Jones as director of the CIA. But then some newcomers, Willem Dafoe, who is my favorite part of this movie by far, Joaquin de Almeida, who plays someone described as a Latin Jack Ryan. And then Miguel Sandoval, who plays the Pablo Escobar stand-in. And the movie was a huge success. It grossed over $200 million at the box office on a budget of $62 million. So this has been sort of Marvel Cinematic Universe numbers, except for an intelligent adult thriller. One can dream for that to happen again.
Yeah, I think it beat out Forrest Gump, which was out around. It replaced it, or as the number one movie in America at the time. People loved it. Strangely enough, critics not so much. There are some very good reviews, but I've been going through the criticism, and a lot of people thought that the plot was too complicated, and that the characters were unsatisfying. And there's some people said the movie was too cynical. Or liked it because it was cynical, and some people said it was too naive about the virtue of its characters. So there was a mixed critical opinion at the time.
Well, I think that actually provides a good place for us to go. Where do you stand on that question? I think the movie has strong elements of both, of being very cynical, but also like kind of naive in a almost endearing way about the U.S. government. But where do you land on that?
That's a really good question. So I think like there's a, you know, my feeling about this movie is that there's really something for everybody in it, in that it does service to a lot of different ideological views of the American government and U.S. foreign policy, and sort of has ways of interpreting in ways that support a lot of different politics, from conservative to, you know, actually quite left-wing criticisms of U.S. foreign policy. I don't know. I think, like, you know, when I watched this movie as a kid, and I watched it many, many times, it did form, it was part of my formation as a young lefty, and being like, America's always fighting, you know, these evil secret covert wars, and, you know, so there was that. But then there's also, you know, it's more on the text, on the surface, it's lionizing of, you know, national security bureaucrats who are honest and good as opposed to the evil ones. And there is also a bit of purient fascination, one might say, with the U.S. war machine and its capacity to, you know, kill people at great distance, you know, from precision airstrikes to commandos and stuff like that. And probably, like, this is sort of a taste of, I mean, this stuff was very present in the Reagan 80s, but you know, a taste of sort of the aesthetics of American violence that, you know, got bigger with the war on terror, like, namely with you know, things like drone strikes and U.S. commando raids and things like that. So I think there's a lot of, I mean, I don't know how intentional it is, but the movie is itself a little bit look, the poster of the movie has Harrison Ford literally draped in an American flag. So I think that on the surface of the text, you know, it's very clear this movie is a patriotic movie that, and even when it has critical parts of, you know, reading of American policy or stuff like that. But on the other hand, you know, I think you can watch this movie as a leftist and be like, yeah, that's what the government does. They're doing stuff like that all the time. And you can watch this movie as a conservative and say, this stuff rocks. I love this kind of thing. And you can watch the movie as a liberal and be like, there are decent people in the government who I trust to, you know, make sure that the U.S. government doesn't do too many bad things.
Right.
What do you think?
Real quick, just for listeners who haven't seen the movie, though, of course, if you have not seen the movie, I strongly recommend you pause this podcast, go check it out. It's available, I want to say, on Amazon streaming, but it's a very easy movie to find.
It's on Netflix right now.
It's on Netflix right now. So a very easy movie to find on streaming. I happen to own a 4K Blu-ray of it because I'm a maniac and I spend too much money on these things. But it's well worth your time. It's actually a very compelling movie. It moves very quickly. Not a plot summary, but just a real quick synopsis. This movie deals with the fallout from a drug cartel murdering an American businessman and his family, that businessman being a friend of the President of the United States, who authorizes a covert war against the Cali cartel that ends up roping in Jack Ryan as he begins to figure out first who this businessman was and then what his connections were and how there's corruption going up to the very top of the American government. And so it's more or less that sets the stage for everything that happens in the film. And as you alluded to, John, once you get past sort of the bureaucratic stuff, and there's a lot of bureaucratic stuff in this movie, and I think actually those are my favorite parts of the movie.
Me too.
The movie also spends a lot of time, far more than the previous Jack Ryan movies do, with the American, I guess Hunt for Red October takes place in the submarine, but with sort of the armed forces engaged in operations against an enemy. And so you have commandos, you know, special forces. There is a scene of an aerial bombing that is very evocative of the war on terror, of footage from drone strikes. At the time, I think it would have been most familiar to viewers as, you know, evocative of footage from the first Iraq War, the Gulf War. You know, there's, you know, lots of famous footage of guided missiles hitting their targets from, you know, you can see from the satellite. And so there's a whole sequence with that. And in that attack, kids are killed. So there's that whole sequence is very war on terror, just in terms of, you know, it's a strike against a compound. There's kids are among the casualties. The policymakers, the national security folks are kind of a little dismayed by what they did, or at least one of them is. The other is sort of like, yeah, who gives a fuck? That guy is played by Henry Searcy. I think it's Searcy.
Yeah, he's great.
His name, Zerny, Henry Zerny, as the character Bob Ritter, and he is great. You've seen him in Mission Impossible, the first movie, and he kind of, it was a great, you know, supporting actor of the 90s, usually played a scumbag. Has that look about him.
He plays a very archetypal evil Reaganite national security bureaucrat in this movie.
Right.
Does a great job.
But the movie does spend a lot of time with the armed forces, and for me it is the time spent with the armed forces and sort of the national security state and the time spent with Ryan are the two ideological poles of the film, right? Sort of the depictions of commando strikes and attacks against the cartel is sort of, look, this is the United States waging a covert war. The audience knows it's an illegal war. That's made very clear at the beginning that the president has authorized something, and but his hands are free of what it may particularly be, but sort of giving it to his national security team to say, you handle it, you take care of it. And you see them take care of it through these, you know, more or less illegal attacks on a sovereign nation to take out the cartels. And then on the Ryan end, all the scenes and sequences of Jack Ryan and his investigation, more or less, are of these competent, you know, patriotic bureaucrats. Some of them are black. I'm always interested in sort of like the depiction of kind of like the multiracial security state.
Yes, me too.
And they are doing sort of the hard work of investigating, the honest work of investigating, the movie seems to say, versus the political machinations of these national security appointees. And it's sort of these two things collide when Ryan figures out that one of the cartel members is in communication with, working with, a member of the president's team, who ends up, you know, betraying the military or the commandos in South America, and that kind of leads you to your final set piece, your final act of the film. This is where Willem Dafoe's character comes in. He plays a character called John Clark, who is a covert ops guy, and he is sort of the go between the people in Washington and the people on the ground. But to me, you know, to me, the movie is, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. To me, the movie is sort of this weird kind of processing of Iran-Contra almost 10 years after the fact. I guess Iran-Contra, the scandal really breaks in 1986. It's not until, 91, that George H.W. Bush pardons a bunch of the participants. He's with guidance from his attorney general, who is Bill Barr. So Bill Barr, you know, his lifelong mission to keep Republican presidents safe from any political accountability for their actions shows up here. But the movie Clear and Present Danger really does seem to give us like a fictional Iran-Contra, at least the Contra part of Iran-Contra, with a president who is very much aware of what he's doing. So it's interesting that this Tom Clancy movie takes, I'd say, this very dim view of the idea that, say, Reagan wasn't aware of what was happening in his name. The movie is saying the president is totally aware, and it's part of sort of these political games, this pretense that he's not.
Right. Yeah, I think that, okay, so yeah, the book itself also is an obvious allusion to Iran-Contra in the case of where it shows an illegal, you know, national security operation that comes through the White House, and it shows, you know, in pretty granular detail for a thriller, or you know, a Hollywood thriller, like the bureaucratic process of starting, you know, a war where the president gives this authorization, and the CIA clandestine ops director wants a copy of it to, you know, function it as cover or as a get out of jail free card if he gets caught. So, you know, it does take a lot of interest in that, and I think it is true that it's kind of critical about the whole idea that Reagan didn't know what was going on, and the present character in the movie is absolutely a sort of this dopey Republican who's obviously supposed to be a little bit of Reagan and a little bit of Bush, and who is sort of reacting to and getting, you know, in the book, the covert operation is going on before this guy's family gets killed, the president's family gets killed. President's friend's family gets killed. So the covert war predates it. So revenge is not the motive in the book so much. But in the movie, they make it so, okay, the Republican president is just doing things out of his kind of emotional reactions to things. And that's leading to all these, you know, problems. And there was also a political motive because he wants to, you know, do something against the cartels because he's, you know, he wants to be reelected, which is gone into much more in the book about how you know, there's an ongoing presidential race. Where was I going with this? So I think that, yeah, the president is depicted as being, you know, culpable and maybe incompetent in a way that would obviously resonate with the way that liberals started to think about Reagan. But, you know, he knew full well what was going on. I mean, the thing about, you know, Reagan and Iran-Contra is that Reagan had a real, because of his background in the movies, these kinds of adventurous intrigues and commandos and sort of like that, he really loved that kind of thing, and he pursued it out of, you know, almost this an aesthetic reasons, and also just because, you know, he would feel like, you know, America was right and powerful and should exercise that power. So that kind of cult of covert ops really grew up in the Reagan years, and this movie definitely has a bit of a critical view of it. There's also, you know, there's also an element that goes back to Vietnam, actually, I found in the movie, like the abandonment of the U.S. troops by the national security bureaucrats, which, and they subsequently get captured by the villains and are like forgotten about and deliberately, you know, covered up by the evil bureaucrats. Is just, you know, basically exactly analogous to the POW MIA myth conspiracy theory that, you know, there are virtuous American troops and they were left behind by American, you know, national security bureaucrats who had their own evil political agendas. And that's just like recapitulating the film. So I think, yeah, there's you're absolutely right that this is processing Iran-Contra and that scandal. But there's another part of it, and the movie alludes to Vietnam a few times, because when Jack Ryan is getting grilled by the senator, she brings up Vietnam, and he promises, because he doesn't know what's going on. He's been kept in the dark by he becomes the deputy director of intelligence. The deputy director of operations, who does the clandestine stuff, is this evil Henry Czerny character. And he's kept in the dark. So he doesn't know, and he promises the senator who brings up Vietnam that there are no advisors, there are no troops, which turns out not to be true. So I think in a way, yeah, there's absolutely Iran-Contra, but the movie really is also still processing the traumas and issues of Vietnam as well. I mean, it's jungle environment, and, you know, it's allusions to the POW MIA stuff, and it's allusions to illegal and secret wars, which is a huge part of our involvement in Vietnam and Indochina in general, is definitely present here. So
there's two things here. The first is that I think you touched on one of the persistent themes of these Clancy movies, and I'll be curious to see if they show up in kind of other films in this genre, which is just the basic, you know, untrustworthiness of politicians and political appointees, that no one political, no one explicitly political in this film has any kind of good motive, and the people whom the film presents to you as, if not pure motive, then at least decent men, are the non-political bureaucrats like Ryan, are the men of the military like Willem Dafoe's character, or any of the commandos. James Earl Jones, he's practically cast for this sort of, you know, gravitas and ability to command respect, but likewise he is presented as kind of untainted by Washington politics, by the petty concerns of politicians. I think you're right as well about the way this movie is processing Vietnam. And the 90s were, you know, part of this longer moment of the country processing Vietnam with a little more distance from the war itself, right? After the big victory of the Gulf War, which is understood in the moment to be this kind of where we're, you know, and we've talked about this before, we're back, baby. American military might is back. We weren't humiliated like we were in Vietnam. There is a bit more, I think, openness in media about thinking through the war, that war and its effects on the soldiers, the American soldiers who fought at the very least. And so John McCain, I believe, goes to back to Vietnam in the 90s. That's when.
Yeah. And that's when we recognize, we fully recognize Vietnam and it, yeah.
Right. And, right. Yeah. So you have our full recognition of Vietnam. John McCain returns. We were talking about Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump is a movie where Vietnam plays a major part in the story, and I think you could also kind of fold that in to the 90s, kind of reconciling the country, reconciling ourselves with Vietnam. I always find it interesting to put movies about American, the use of military force, American military, within the context of the mid-90s kind of greatest generation thing. I have no better noun for it, but sort of, you know, if Saving Private Ryan at the end of the decade,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You have kind of the recognition that the generation that fought World War II is coming to an end, and so there's a lot more memorialization going on around that.
Right.
There's also the 50th anniversary of the end of the war in 95. So there's a lot of that happening, and I even if this movie doesn't directly touch on that stuff, I like to. It's in the atmosphere, and I think it's worth noting that it's in the atmosphere.
I think, you know, along with, you know, there's this division between, as you pointed out, like the evil bureaucrats and the good professionals of Greer and Ryan. And it's interesting that, you know, this kind of aligns with a certain, it's not exactly mythology, but it's maybe overemphasized that there's a division in the CIA itself between the clandestine service operations guys who go around blowing things up and assassinating people and the intelligence wing of the CIA. And, you know, often there's a political dimension to this where the CIA's intelligence gathering wing is traditionally a little bit more liberal. The clandestine service is a little bit more conservative. This movie, well, John Clark, Willem Dafoe's character, is part of the clandestine service, and it presents him in a positive light. But it presents the head of the clandestine service as a real son of a bitch, and the head of intelligence as a very upright and honorable guy, are the two people who end up taking that role in the movie. So it's kind of recreating that. But, you know, there's a connection to Vietnam there, too, because, you know, the story there goes, and, you know, this some version of this repeated with the Iraq War, is that the intelligence wing of the CIA was honestly reporting what was going on, but, you know, the political needs of Washington and the Pentagon kept on overriding their negative reports. So there's a little bit of like, look, there's the good wing, the good guys in the CIA are the intelligence guys, and the bad guys in the CIA are the clandestine service guys thing being recapitulated by this movie. And, you know, that obviously is a story that liberals like, because liberals, the intelligence guys at the CIA tend to be liberals or more liberal. The problem with that story is that it's not this ideal that the movie stipulates about kind of like apolitical, totally professional people in the CIA is just not true. Even the relatively liberal products of the intelligence side who have been CIA directors have, you know, used the CIA as part of the president's political agenda. And that's the way it works. And they've falsified, downplayed, exaggerated intelligence in order to fit in with whatever the political agenda of the White House is. So, you know, I think that this, It would be nice to imagine that, you know, there are these members of these great security bureaucracies who are utterly professional and unswayable by political, you know, considerations. And that's, I just think, not true, and a myth probably better dispensed with, although one that, you know, obviously has its attractions. But I mean, it's, you know, look at Greer, the Admiral Greer, who is dying of cancer in the movie, and it adds, you know, considerable pathos to it, who is, as you pointed out, you know, clearly meant to read as Colin Powell, classically, you know, one of the great professional truth tellers of, you know, American national security apparatus, and we all know, you know, how he got swept up or was complicit in, you know, the political agenda of the Bush administration. So I think that this kind of idea that, you know, there are people who are not subject to political pressures and can see through it and will do the right thing is a little difficult to believe after the war on terror, you know, and probably should have been difficult to believe after Vietnam and Iran-Contra and stuff like that. But the movie definitely seems to think it's still there.
John, you found, for the record, before we started recording, you found some excerpts from this Tom Clancy Reader that was published in 92, the Tom Clancy Companion, that deals with, I suppose, just like looks at the books published up till then, and then has interviews and lots of photographs and articles and such about Clancy. And the thing, the excerpt in particular that I thought was really interesting, that I thought made an interesting point, was that in the novel, and I think this is the case in the movie, in the novel and in the movie, despite the fact, now I'm just going to quote from this piece, despite the fact that the CIA agents were running a secret military operation inside the borders of a friendly nation, which is patently illegal, despite the fact that children, innocent civilians, were caught in the crossfire, despite the fact that the whole scheme is run without the approval of Congress or the knowledge of the American people, despite all these things, the operation actually worked. Once the forces of law and order stopped playing by the book and stepped outside the bonds of acceptable civilized behavior, the cartel didn't have a chance. And this, I mean, this is definitely the case in the movie, that although this is all a political debacle for the president in the end, it's also true that by the time Harrison Ford gets onto that helicopter with Willem Dafoe and they're being airlifted out of the cartel base or whatever you want to call it, every single member of the cartel has been killed. Every leader of the cartel has been killed by that point, either by American forces or through circumstance, but they've all been killed. The cartel has like largely been dismantled. The covert illegal war actually worked to secure American national security. And I think that's what, I mean, you know, one way you could describe the politics of this movie are kind of a little incoherent. That's maybe the less charitable way to describe them. But to me, it does seem to speak to an attitude that I certainly believe was prevalent in the 1990s, of course became kind of dominant in the 2000s, which is this idea that, you know, sometimes you just have to take the gloves off.
Yes.
Sometimes you just have to ignore what's legal, what's right, and then fight fire with fire, as it were. And in the movie, Jack Ryan kind of exists to say, no, that's unacceptable. You have to do things by the book. You have to defend the Constitution. There's a scene that's a trailer. It's a trailer scene, right? They put it right in the trailer where Ryan is standing up to the president and kind of dressing him down in the Oval Office.
He actually says the cliche that everybody makes fun of, "How dare you, sir," to the president. Yeah.
But I think the movie is tapping into something that people very much believed, which is that when it comes to non-state adversaries like a cartel, like terrorists, that the old rules no longer apply.
Right. You know, I think that is really the core of the most reactionary part of the politics of this movie, is that it's suggestion that the U.S. military should have absolutely no constraints on its application of violence is a long-standing right-wing belief that goes back to the failure in Vietnam being the result of, you know, our limited war there, and we should have just dropped the bomb on them and had it over with. And obviously, you know, this has a certain resonance with the way Colonel Kurtz is fighting the war in Apocalypse Now, with, you know, so there, and we've seen the modern version of this with Trump's attitude towards foreign policy, which is, you know, bomb the shit out of them, that the, you know, we don't have time for these humanitarian considerations. you know, this is, you know, American war, the imagination of American war, of a pretty hard right ilk, which suggests we can win everything if we just don't care about morality and we go for it. Which is somewhat belied by the fact that we don't care that much about morality. We do go for it and we still have problems, you know, but then it always becomes a kind of a stab in the back story, which is again, like we were discussing, the bureaucrats, the politicians, the weak liberals are the reason why we lost this war. And if we had been able to do what the military can do, we would have won. And I'm sure there's a version of this will happen with Afghanistan now too. So yeah, that is like, you know, that is the part of the movie and the novel, it seems, that is really the most hard right vision of American foreign policy, which is that where it's being constrained by, you know, weak and effete forces in the United States. And if it were unchained, it would achieve victory in every single case. And we just know that that's it's not true. I mean, and there is very little, you know, okay. You know, this brings me to something I wanted to talk about with Patriot Games, and I forgot to, but it fits in perfectly with this movie and it fits in with all of these movies. And the whole theme of our podcast is the fantasy of unlimited American power. In the scene in Patriot Games that we discussed, looking like the Bin Laden raid, as well as the scenes in this movie that show commandos striking wherever across the world, our Air Force able to precision strike, you know, a compound full of drug dealers.
Not just a compound full of drug dealers, but a particular truck at a compound
full
of drug dealers.
Right. We drop the bomb right down with a laser guided. Yeah. You know, there's this fantasy of these movies all partake in one way or the other in a fantasy of unlimited American power, which really conditioned the way we think about the United States up until the war on terror and 9/11. When, you know, I remember as a kid, and this reoccurred to me when I was watching Patriot Games in this movie, when 9/11 happened, I told my mom, they're going to kill Bin Laden tonight. Because I was so indoctrinated in this idea that, you know, oh, we only just have to apply this military power and, you know, it will be done competently by these guys and they'll find him immediately, because I'd seen all these movies where these incredible commando strikes and stuff like that. So, and it's understandable that after the Cold War that the United States was indulged in that. But, you know, as you pointed out, this is not long after Black Hawk Down, where, you know, we had a traumatic experience of the limits of American power. And also, as we talked about in the cover of the newspaper, the U.S.'s lack of action in Rwanda was probably something more interventionist liberals decried than conservatives, but also a point where the U.S. didn't take action and it was felt to be a horrible mistake, and maybe we should have. So these movies definitely build up the image of an American power that really has no limits, and the only obstacle to American power is some kind of internal evil. Either in the form of, you know, these of politics itself, or, you know, evil bureaucrats or something like that.
I mean, sort of related. So I agree. First of all, I absolutely agree that this movie and all these movies have this fantasy of unlimited American power, of a United States which can project its power perfectly without any real friction whatsoever. And that the only, as you said, the only friction comes when political actors get in the way of the military, of the hyper competent military doing its job. Again, and I feel compelled to note a military that is presented in this movie as, again, being multiracial, multicultural, right? Sort of our kind of our main military character is Hispanic. The other thing I would say on this point is that, you know, because the 1990s are this point where the United States stands alone as a superpower, there is a sense that now it's time to take care of things we've neglected within our own borders, right? So this is where the war on drugs, you know, heats up, you know, international operations sort of shut down cartels and stop the flow of drugs in the United States. And that's very much a part of this. And there's this idea, this notion that taking that this is all kind of like a mop-up operation, right? That sort of once we turn our attention to the things we've neglected while dealing with the Soviet Union, we'll have no problems dealing or handling things like cartels or in Patriot Games like international terrorism or whatnot. And the the reality of the fact that these things are not particularly simple or clear-cut to deal with, that you can't just exert military power to take care of them. But this movie, for as much as it has a somewhat jaundiced view of the national security state, it does maintain this idea that, yeah, with just like a well-timed application of military power, the United States can take care of these clear and present threats to American national security, which may not be existential, but are still at least embarrassing. And the president in this film is, if nothing else, embarrassed by the extent to which cartels can harm American citizens.
Yeah, he says, what do you think? What do they think? We're powerless? We can't do anything about this?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm thinking, right now I'm thinking of how the right-wing critique of Clinton was essentially that he was sort of feckless and impotent on the international stage. I mean, that's kind of a common right-wing critique of Democratic presidents, but I think it very much Clinton being sort of, the first boomer president, the first child of the 60s to become president of the United States, I think that was very much a part of the critique of Clinton, which is that this... This horny guy is not actually prepared to handle American national security. He'll leave us vulnerable to threats that we're obviously able to take care of with nothing more than a focused application of military force.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up the horny thing, because I was thinking about this in relation to Patriot Games and the movie's kind of sexual and gender politics. It's like, in this movie, those movies like punish people for having extramarital sex a lot, and this movie does too. Like the FBI director's assistant who gets seduced by the evil Latin Jack Ryan character, gets murdered, and Patriot Games like is a little more sexually explicit than the other movies, and it shows like Jack's romantic life, and it also shows like, kind of this weird free-flowing sexual energy among the IRA people, which is disturbing in the telling of the movie, which is maybe a little racist towards Irish people.
I mean, it's kind of those hot-blooded Irish.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and I think that there's a real message like, okay, like self-control, the family, these are important virtues that permit the nation to operate smoothly, and the unrestrained passions, whether or not they're for revenge or for sexuality or so on and so forth, are what creates problems. Of course, Jack has his own passionate outbursts, either out of love for his wife or anger protecting his family, or anger over the wrong thing being done, but it's really focused, and like that's like what the ideological universe the movie suggests is like these things have to be focused. Sexuality within the family, anger at the bad guys, like at the violation of the Constitution. So it's like, yeah, it imagines like a really well-organized American society along pretty traditional Republican values, and it doesn't imagine that like, and it imagines the kind of, as we've talked about, the more neocon or Pappy Bush version of it, more than neocon, which is a little bit more like, well, anybody can be a part of it. You don't have to be a white guy. You can be, we'll take anybody. You just got to show that you can do it. So there's like this meritocratic aspect of it, which we've talked about, and multiracial aspect of it. But yeah, it's like, as long as you behave according to the strictures of WASP morality, then, the country will work well. And the you know, our foreign issues will be solved. But you know, those things getting corrupted is where things start to go wrong. So yeah, I mean, like, the movie's, you know, doesn't have a huge role for Ann Archer, Jack's wife. She's not presented as, like, she's a career, like, the gender politics are interesting because she's, like, obviously very smart. She's a career woman. She is a doctor, and she has, you know, but she's not, like, subservient to Jack. But it's clear, it's like, look, this couple is, like, an ideal American couple where it's, like, the guy is really good. The woman, she's got her own career. She can do her own thing. But, like, the guy's in charge and the one out there saving the world. So I thought that was kind of interesting about these movies, which is they're little subtle, which is not, like, foregrounded in a plot at all, but they're little subtle pieces of ideology like that.
Well, I mean, you know, in talking about this podcast, whenever we're chatting about it online or whatnot, it's referred to as a podcast about dad movies. And, you know, I think these three Tom Clancy movies are just extremely male. You know, Ann Archer, the Jack Ryan's wife is the only character who, Kathy Ryan is the only character in the three movies, only woman character who has a significant speaking role. Maybe in Patriot Games, the IRA terrorist woman, but she doesn't speak that much.
She basically says nothing. Right. And she always is constantly, like, using her sexual attraction to, like, seduce and destroy her enemies and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But as far as just a speaking role, someone who's recognizably a character, it's really just Kathy Ryan. Whether it's Gates McFadden playing her in Hunt for Red October for a moment, or Ann Archer in these other two movies. But the everything else takes place among men. All the drama, all of the emotional lows and highs, all of that, it's pretty much exclusively male. And I do think, I mean, the 90s are when you are getting this discourse about the feminizing of America, of the American man, of sort of, you know, our American men. And again, I think this is very explicitly related to the Greatest Generation, World War II memorialization, right? Like, are the grandchildren of the men who beat the Nazis capable of capable of taking up their inheritance in American manhood? And I can see how in that environment where this is just a regular, this is a part of the political and cultural conversation, that a movie like Clear and Present Danger and this genre in general does sort of land in fertile ground, right? People want to watch movies about, you know, competent, virile men. And that's what Harrison Ford is playing here, a hyper-competent, virile man. And it's not for nothing, and we talked about this in the Patriot Games episode, it's not for nothing that the next Republican president after Bill Clinton is someone who presents himself in exactly that mold.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of Tom Clancy didn't like the idea of Harrison Ford becoming Jack Ryan because he felt he was too old. And I think that, like, you know, I think Harrison Ford's depiction of Jack Ryan is kind of cool because he presents him, you know, as a dad and as a kind of, you know, it's an assertive type of masculinity, but it's also kind of like a hesitant and bashful one at the same time. And, like, he's a good actor, and his emotions are interesting in the movie. So I think that Tom Clancy's imagination of Jack Ryan is much dumber and is more like he's just like a really young, strapping, you know, not very complicated man. And, you know, I think Harrison Ford's depiction of him is kind of like, you know, he's middle class, he's slightly domesticated. He would really rather be with his family. He's an analyst. He's not a natural, he was in the Marines, but he's not a natural action hero. And, you know, he's an office worker. He's a middle-class guy who has a family that he would prefer to spend his time with, but he has to do the right thing and, you know, go out and save the country and be decent and so forth. So, you know, obviously, like, that appeals to middle class fathers who probably from time to time feel that their jobs are not, you know, that might be emasculating or something like that. But, and they don't have the opportunity to go out and punch bad guys. But, you know, yeah, so I think, like, the movie's dealing with it in ways that can make, like, Republicans and Democrats or liberals and conservatives both happy, which it's like, they're like, he's a good dad, and his wife is a smart lady who's got her own career, and they've got a nice family, and but he's also, like, you know, a man of action, and, you know, so, yeah, I mean, again, like, I think the gender and family politics of the movies are something that can you know, appeal, you know, have broad appeals across the political and cultural spectrum of the United States and make pretty much everybody happy, which is, I think, like, one of the, these movies, in addition to, like, the myth of American power that they have, also add to the myth of American consensus. Like, we all love Jack Ryan, don't we? And we all know that these are the good guys. And I think that, you know, it was very, including me, I will cop to this, it was very traumatic for some American liberals and even leftists to witness the breakdown where we couldn't even agree that there were certain sacred aspects of centrist consensus that shouldn't be touched. So it was almost as if Trump, when he starts insulting everybody in the national security state, is insulting Jack Ryan. And we all know Jack Ryan is a good guy, and we can all agree on he's strong, he's out there protecting America, but he's not a racist. You know, his mentor was a black guy, and he looked up to him sincerely. And, like, you know, I think that in a way, one way of, we talk about this up going up to 9/11, but I think we have to think about these movies going up to Trump too, because there was so much of the, or a split in the understanding of this ideology, which we thought everybody understood in the same way. And then we see, oh my God, we weren't watching the same movie at all. You know, like, they were watching, you know, the parts where the people get blown up and that's, and it's awesome. And we were like, us liberals were like, oh, that Jack Ryan, decent guy. So there was I think that there was, like, these movies added to this consensus about American values, about American democracy, and what was considered to be, like, good. And that's the apolitical, that adds into the whole apolitical aspect of it. And, you know, we realized, and I think Obama really, his politics already also participate. You know, we talked about how George W. Bush, in some way, participates in the Jack Ryan universe, but I think Barack Obama definitely participates in it. Politics participates in it, you know, and I think it was very traumatic for a lot of people to see Trump really cast aside the illusions, all the ideological illusions that were created by these sorts of films about what was distinctly American, what was good about America. And I don't think all those fictions necessarily are, you know, there are, as we've discussed, there's probably a time to put them aside. Do I think that they were all totally destructive and bad? No. But I think, you know, the losing some of that mythology that was built up after the Cold War with the rise of Trump is interesting. When looking at these movies again, you're like, what world is this? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right. I mean, if there's a guiding mythology through Clear and Present Danger and through these three Jack Ryan movies broadly, it is this sense that American foreign policy, exists somewhere a moral center to American foreign policy, and it's the task of men like Jack Ryan to continuously bring it to the foreground. Sort of, there's going to be resistance to foregrounding that morality. In this movie, it's the president and his cronies. In The Hunt for Red October, it is the military establishment that does not want to try to take a chance on whether Sean Connery's character is actually trying to defect. This is, I think, a lesser element of Patriot Games, but it's still there. since the antagonist, there isn't so much bureaucratic antagonism in that movie.
I think your point stands even for Patriot Games, because the traitor is a member of the royal household's bureaucratic staff. He's so I think your point stands, actually. That movie actually just makes the treason much more explicit.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But there's a moral core that can be steered awry for, you know, venal political reasons, but there's these dedicated patriots within the government, within the military, within the national security state, who can bring us back on track. And I think what was one of the things that was traumatic about Trump, that I think, you know, should he return to the stage as a candidate, will be reminded of this again, is the extent to which he himself has this. How do I describe this? It is, if you were to take the left-wing critique of American foreign policy and personify it as, you know, a foreign policy that is amoral, that is solely interested in accumulating capital and exploiting other nations, that was Trump's vision for American foreign policy, and he presents it as sort of like, this is what we ought to be doing. It's like in some this weird way he divined the left wing critique, and then was like, oh, well, that actually sounds good. We should that's what we should be doing. And the extent to which the public, or a large portion of the public, was like, hell yeah, that's exactly what we should be doing. It's sort of a traumatic thing for a lot of liberals to see and absorb, because you're right. I think it demonstrates that we didn't have this consensus about the way things ought to be, even if they really weren't that way at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think also just like this movie plays into there's two things I want to say. It's like, this movie just plays into the idea, I think, like, liberals just projected the fact that there were like all these conservative Jack Ryans out there that were going to, like, you know, resist Trump from within the deep state and stuff like that. So, you know, and people on the left rightly were like, well, every person that you say is a conservative Jack Ryan who's resisting Trump, they did torture, or they lied about the Iraq War, or something like that. You know, so I think, you know, some of the process of getting rid of these illusions has been healthy. I do think that the other side of it, though, is that the sheer cynicism of Trump, and the sheer willingness to engage in what the United States probably was in essence doing a lot of these cases, but without the pretense to any kind of moral content to it, is not healthy. The just embrace of total cynicism. And I would say that the mystifications and whatever is wrong with the visions in these films is to be preferred to that level of cynicism. And I think that's kind of why I have some nostalgic feelings towards them, and I still enjoy them as films and think they're good. The other thing I wanted to say is this movie has a stock character, which I think we will encounter in a lot of the films that we're talking about, which I like to call a spicy bureaucrat, which is played by, you know, the deputy director for operations, who's that great character actor who plays him,
Henry Zerny.
Yeah, and like this is like a, you know, we were talking about this the other day. There is a certain aspect in which, and this is hugely a part of our cultural conversation now, after COVID, after Trump, there's a part of where expertise, bureaucratic and technocratic expertise, is a certain kind of like public performance of competence. And like, we invest a lot in that public performance of competence. And then there's two ways of dealing with it. There's these kind of evil Machiavellian spicy bureaucrat guy who's like, knows all the angles and is, you know, twisting the system for evil. And then there's these like Jack Ryan virtuous Admiral Greer, virtuous figures. But it's interesting to me, like, these movies depict, like, they show literally, because it's a performance, like, yeah, they depict bureaucratic competence aside from politics. The theater of politics is a little bit more widely known and acknowledged than the theater of bureaucratic expertise. But these movies prime us to think about those characters as having certain amounts of competence, even if it's evil competence or expertise, even if it's used for bad. And I think that's just really interesting. Again, this plugs into the way we've sort of become so disillusioned about certain aspects of our culture, our political culture, is that a lot of these figures of unalloyed competence and expertise don't seem so plausible in the present, or we have nostalgia for them or kind of almost fetishistic worship of them. But does anybody really believe it? No. I mean, after Iraq, is it even possible to believe in it? I mean, I think maybe Colin Powell was the last person we might have said something like that about. And it's impossible to say that about him now, because we all know what happened. I mean, look, I think when he died, it's interesting that this character Greer dies in the movie, because it's almost like a pre-imagining of Colin Powell's death. And then there's this very moving scene of his funeral where the president is eulogizing him, and it's cut with the scenes of the American soldiers being shot and killed after being betrayed. And it's a wonderful scene of dramatic irony. And, you know, the president's words are empty. He's betrayed American soldiers. And the true spirit of America is dead and is being eulogized. And, you know, I think there was a real effort after the death of Colin Powell to sort of do, and the death of John McCain, to go through that kind of ritual where we celebrate the life of a super political statesman type figure. And it didn't really work. It was too complicated, and we know too much now. You know, and I think that that's good in certain ways, but I sort of felt a sort of, you know, when I was listening to the coverage of Colin Powell and I heard his former associates very movingly eulogize him on the radio, and they were obviously very emotionally affected by it, I was like, I can see what they're trying to do, and I am not unaffected by it because I grew up primed to respond to these sorts of things by these movies, by the, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think it really works anymore, because I remember what happened during the Iraq War. I remember the careers of all these people, and the kind of rising above and forgetting that I think American ideology relies on is just no longer working because of the immediate access of the historical record that we have now, where it's just like, dude, first of all, I lived through it, but I'm like, I can Google in 2 seconds, I can tell you everything wrong this security official did, you know? Like, there's no mystery. You don't need a journalist to work for years and years and years to gather all the information. So it's interesting, like, I wonder how much these performances of public and civic virtue, which I think are important in a certain way, and I don't want to completely condemn, but I don't think they're working anymore. And I think that we just need to have higher standards. But I was wondering what you thought about that. And especially, I know we were talking a little bit after the death of Colin Powell, but as that is a public event.
Dude, that's a great observation. It is, you know, to the extent that Americans were able to at least sort of like indulge the fantasy of the virtuous national security bureaucrat in the 90s, or at least in the early 90s, it is because, again, it's coming after this great ideological struggle that was the Cold War. So American victory in the Cold War, even if it wasn't necessarily military victory, was a victory of the national security state. And thus the virtues of that victory can kind of be like imposed upon the members of that state. So like, to use Colin Powell as the example, it's not just that he was sort of the general who crafted the Victoria strategy in the Gulf War, but sort of he, you know, all of that's coming as the Soviet Union has collapsed, as America is taking its preeminent role in the world. And so Colin Powell ends up being kind of the avatar for all of these developments, right? Sort of the four for triumphant America, for diverse America, for all of these things. But there have not been victories the same way, right, that can serve that purpose of essentially laundering the reputations of everyone involved in this stuff. The Iraq War is obviously a debacle. Afghanistan, obviously a debacle. And the record of the American military, at least in these terms, and of the national security state, has been less of triumph and more of sort of failure, right? There's been no big dramatic victory other than, I suppose, the bin Laden raid in 2011. But even then, that didn't really have like a singular person associated with it. And its political dividends don't appear to have lasted very, very long past that. And so I'm not sure, I am not sure, like you, that it's possible to even have that kind of, public understanding, public admiration for a figure. They tried hard with Colin Powell. They've tried very hard with John McCain, but the distance from the events that made them household names is great enough that it's overshadowed by the events of the last 20 years, really of 2001 to 2009.
Yeah. I think it's also just like, it's murder. Like the thing that's going on now is there's no way, and this comes out in that scene in Patriot Games where Jack Ryan is looking quite disturbed, in the same way that famous pictures of Barack Obama looks very perturbed watching the bin Laden raid. It's like, the way we do war now is murder. It's very focused. I mean, maybe it always was, but it's very focused and concentrated assassination, essentially. And, you know, that it's very difficult for that to have the same kind of air of heroism as previous eras of warfare. So we are celebrating. It's difficult. Like, I think that's why, I mean, we're going to talk about this eventually, but American Sniper was such a complicated movie on an ideological level. It's just like the form warfare has taken and what we know about it is so unheroic and so cold and calculated and murderous that it's just like, even when people celebrate it, like what's getting celebrated is like you're not celebrating like soldiers seizing a hill, you're celebrating a death squad, like, yeah. That's, you know, so it's just like, it's very difficult for the same air of heroic bravery and conduct to be attached to all these things. And, you know, in the case of the Civil War, I mean, in the case of the Cold War, the combination of, you know, the combination of statesmanship and being brave and resolute in the face of the Soviet threat, which, whatever. But you know, I think that that's just really difficult, even for people who are into it, to fully, you know, get the sense that, you know, this is a war, and this is not just like, okay, this is systematic political assassinations undertaken to carry out, you know, our foreign policy.
And I'll say, I think some of this shows up in Clear and Present Danger. I mean, part of the political risk for the president in this movie is precisely that people will not see this as sort of a just war, but as kind of, yeah, an assassination squad going after anonymous rivals and killing kids in the process. I think we should wrap up soon. So any last thoughts?
I think this is one. I mean, okay. So my love for Hunt for October is infinite, but this is really, I think, in terms of the themes and all of the things it says about American ideology, nationalism, foreign policy, this is maybe the most interesting one of the movies. And it's interesting that, you know, the public responded so enthusiastically to it, and critics kind of seemed to think that the public was going to lose patience with it, and find the plot to be too dense or something like that. But then people just loved it and couldn't get enough of it. And I think probably because, like I said at the beginning, it touched on all these serious issues in a way that wasn't too obtrusive or preachy and allowed people to just enjoy it as a thriller. But it's like, yeah, there's a lot of things going on here that are about America and its foreign policy that are being dealt with, you know, in a relatively intelligent and sensitive way. And obviously it comes with all the bullshit that we all grew up with, but it also kind of in a way has aspects where it shows that it is bullshit or these things are bad and problematic. So it's a very interesting movie, and I get something out of it every time I watch it.
No, I agree. And I think, I mean, I like to think how would a movie be received if it were made today. And I think that the extent to which the movie does posit sort of a virtuous bureaucratic establishment, or at least virtuous bureaucrats, would not land well. But certainly the critiques or the jaded eye the movie takes towards the conduct of American foreign policy would be, I think, very, very much in keeping with the present day mood. And I can imagine this movie coming out today and actually being a flashpoint of controversy, right, for its depiction of the national security state, which is just interesting thing to think about. I don't think you would necessarily think of a Tom Clancy movie of having that kind of heat, but this one, for whatever reason, does. Maybe it's because the screenwriters and the creative team saw something in Clancy's story that Clancy didn't necessarily put there, but it's certainly there. Although some of it, you know, as we discussed, Clancy in this novel is a little more skeptical than he typically is, but I love this movie. I think it's incredibly watchable, I think when people think about this genre of movie, this is what they're thinking of. Like, it's this look, this rhythm, this sort of tone. This is what people are thinking of when I think of these movies, and I think I think it's archetypal for a reason, and for a good reason, at that.
Yeah, I have one last thought, which is that and it's kind of a downer, so I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But I think the most naive and unrealistic part of this movie is this assumption that the United States is a functioning democracy, because it's incredibly serious to have lied to Congress. It's incredibly serious that the president did an illegal war, and this is all going to come out, and the committees will find it out, and the media will take it seriously. And that's, like, perhaps the most appealing part of the movie in some way, but maybe the most unrealistic, unfortunately.
Right. I mean, it's a movie that, in that sense, it's, like, very much stuck in the post-Watergate era, where it did seem as if, like, the institutions of accountability worked, but if this movie is supposed to be processing Iran-Contra, then the thing about Iran-Contra is that, like, no one gave a shit.
Yeah, it was really, everyone got away with it, and really very little was changed. And we see, unfortunately, the effects of not taking these sorts of inquiries seriously going on to the present day.
Right.
But yeah.
Okay, well, that was Clear and Present Danger, everyone. Our next, so as always, this podcast comes out every other week, and so our next movie is not going to be a Tom Clancy movie, because there were only 3 Clancy movies made in the 90s. The next one is The Sum of All Fears, which is released in 2002. So instead of jumping into the 2000s, what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the beginning of the decade and kind of move through this genre of film in a mostly chronological manner. Sometimes we may break chronology just to talk about something we want to talk about. But for now, we're going to go chronological. And we're not going to start in 1990 necessarily. We're going to start with sort of the very, very late Cold War. And so our next episode will be on the 1987 Kevin Costner thriller, No Way Out, which I've never seen. I don't know. Have you seen it, John?
No, I've never even heard of it.
There you go.
So I'm very interested, yeah.
I've never seen it. I've heard very good things. Every time I've mentioned this to people, they are excited to hear what I have to say. So that will be our next episode coming to you 2 weeks from when this was released, so in December. Until then, that is our show. If you are not a subscriber to the Unclear and Present Danger podcast, please subscribe. We are available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Google Podcasts, and wherever else podcasts are found. If you subscribe, please leave a rating and a review. It helps people find the show. A lot of you have been leaving ratings and reviews, and we really appreciate it. You can reach out to both of us on Twitter. I'm at JBowie. John, you are?
I'm at Lionel_trolling.
You can also reach us at our feedback email. The feedback email is unclearandpresentfeedback@fastmail.com. For John Gans, I am Jamel Bowie, and this is the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. We will see you next time.